Accession number 32589. Reel 3.
What sort of mines were used?
Mines. Two types. Anti-tank and anti-personnel, basically. The anti-personnel were two types. They were butterfly bombs and shoe mines, which are wooden and plastic shoe. But the original ones, shoe is the German shoe. Only about 2 inches of explosive. I'll have to nip upstairs. The
shoe mines were much more dangerous than any accidents that we'd had. And we did have a few with the shoe mines because they were usually under the ground, about 4 inches, and not easy to detect. You could prod for them with a bayonet, but you could still miss them because they're only quite small. About as big as your white packet.
Right. So, what should we do next?
Well, just on the subject of mines, still, how effective were they as a tactic or as a defence?
My short answer would be not very. They inhibited our activities in no man's land. The Chinese used them against us. They'd pin us against our own minefields. Our fighting patrols were 15 men. Theirs were 45. And the only way out was across a minefield. And I was on one of my minefield jaunts once when this happened. And try to remember his name. I had a chap with me from who was a regular, who'd been in this draft of 45, and I think he came from the York and Lancaster Regiment or West Yorks. I'm not sure whether he's from Sheffield or Leeds, but he ran across the minefield. Nobody told him to, and nearly got it, nearly made it. Hit a mine and got injured, and there were about six of us, and it was an odd situation. There was a standing patrol of three, which is a normal number. They'd reinforced it with another three to help me and my assistant, because I wanted to go and do the minefield. Now, there were times when the company commander wouldn't let us go through his lines. Even when we were on anti-sniper duties, they were afraid that we'd bring fire on them and cause casualties. And it was a valid fear. I was on one forward position once when we were shot up by a tank in the other brigade. The Durham Light Infantry sector just moved in. We were shot up by one of our own tanks, and the Chinese didn't realise what was happening. We had to move onto the forward slope because the hoochies on the rear slope that everybody lived in were being shelled by one of our centurions. And the communication system was such that although I knew the communications net, it meant going from platoon to company headquarters on a 88 set, which is a little, only had a 2 kilometer range. From there by 31 set to battalion. From battalion to, I think we were 27 brigade. And from 27 brigade to 29 brigade, which was probably not possible. They'd probably have to go through div headquarters. And then that, so there were about 10 links in the radio chain. And we'd know, and the tanks had their own radio net on a different frequency, and it was about an hour before it got stopped. And we must have had about 50 shells come zipping in and blowing up hooches. It's a wonder nobody was hurt, but that was one of the awkwardnesses of that situation. But the minefields, now take this this injury, Amy, AD. I have a friend who was in Charlie Company when I was in Charlie Company, who ended up as an RSM, and he's at Strensville Barracks in York, and I see him about once a year when I deliver wine up there for the Army Benevolent Fund. And I happened to say to him, I said, what happened to you? It wasn't AD, but it was a name like that. He said, that's a name I haven't heard mentioned for years. He said he was from Sheffield. And anyway, he went across this minefield, and I went on leave to Curie sometime afterwards, and I knew he was in hospital there, so I went to see him. And it was a big old barrack block, and they were in what are called in the army Nightingale wards, about 40 men, beds down either side. Sisters table down the middle, and the male and female staff are sitting. And I come in through the doors, and the top of the voice conversation went like this. He was lying at the other end with his typical foot in the air. And he sees me come in and he shouts, "Corporal fucking Whisper, you'll never make a fucking officer." He says, "You can't make up your fucking mind." And I walked out as quick as I could to shoot him up. Everybody's looking at, they didn't know where to laugh or to look, you know. And the little sister in her QARNC uniform, which is a little red shoulder cloak, and buzzing down in front of me. "Now, just a minute, Private Senator." And anyway, I get there, and I say, "Well," I said, "I think you did very well, and I put you in for a medal." "Nobody's going to take any news of a fucking corporal." And as it happened, I wasn't in control of the situation. We had two Bren guns, and they were out at either end, and we were spread about from here to 50 yards up there. And but knowing the minefields, I was going to go the other way. It was flat at the bottom where we were, in this hill, and the C Company, Charlie Company's hill, a convex slope going up there, quite steep and quite high. And he ran across the top end of the minefield, and the Chinese had pinned us into that triangle between the hill and the minefield and the flat ground which they occupied. Now, I was waiting until they moved some more of their men round onto that side and thinned out at that, because we were going down the minefield, into the stream, down the stream, back of the minefield, and let them run across it. But except I wasn't in contact. I hadn't even communicated my thoughts to anybody, let alone anything else. But that was. But before I could do it, I heard them. There was a lull, and I shouted. You know, "Follow his tracks and get him out the other side." And two went, and then another two, and then we all went that way as it happened. But it would have been a damn sight safer going the other way. You know, we might have got away without anybody being hurt. But I mean, even with only one casualty, was lucky as it happened. But anyway, it officially, nobody knew I was there, and we didn't talk about it afterwards. Because it was all done on the, you know, I think the company sergeant major knew, probably the company commander didn't even know. And they knew that he'd got hurt, but he was under standing patrol anyway. There we are. There is always among soldiers an informal communications net. And, for example, when we're on the hook reserve position, which is where this Russian incident had occurred, when we occupied that ourselves later, a phone call came through. They said, I think it went something like this, it's on the intelligence office phone. "You know Clive Watson of Lingdale?" said the voice at the other end. I said, "Yes, because I lived in Boosbeck. Lingdale was the next village in there." I said, "Yes. He used to take out my sister. Well, he's just been blown up with a petrol can, badly burnt. And it'll take at least an hour for the ambulance jeep to come up from your end. Can you get a helicopter off the Americans?" pick him up. I said, I'll try. You better put out your helicopter panels. And now we were down by the Imjin, and we were in a low hills, and about 3 kilometres away with this, the Americans. Now this was an 8-inch gun battery, nicknamed the Persuaders. And in my musketry order and my 2 bandoliers of ammunition in my rifle, I trotted the 3 kilometres across the flood rim. I was a cross-country runner. I used to lead the battalion team when we'd been in reserve at in Div Rear, just before, 3 months before. And got to the gate, the Negro military policeman pointed me out the medical officer. He said, straight up this line of marquees. Out, you see a cross tent with a Red Cross medical officer in there. And I said, we've got a man badly burnt. We can't get him out fast enough by ambulance. So could you send a helicopter? Now, they had helicopters not for rescue purposes, simply to bring up ammunition underslung from their A echelon way back. When they were firing in a battle, they had, I think, 4 helicopters, which were on the move all the time, ferrying up 2 tons of ammunition. And the rest of the time, they had much to do. And he said, can you give an 8-figure reference? I said, where's your map? And, he said, I said, I've told them to put their air panels out as well. Good, he said. He said, do you want to go? I said, I want to get my breath back, and I'd better get back to my headquarters before he knows I'm missing. I said, can you take the Indian Field Ambulance? That's our brigade field ambulance. He said, sure, he said, and that was that. And it turned out that he died 11 days later. His injuries. But regulations wouldn't allow me to write to Dinah Brown, his wife by then, who I used to sit beside in the village school until 28 days had gone. And when I wrote to her when I got back, it was only 6 months later, back to my village, and whenever there was anything going on in the village, Dinah used to come and talk to me and sit beside me. And and then last year, and by some trick of chance, I was putting in central heating in some of my houses in Corby. I'm in rented buy-to-let property, some of which I inherited from my mother. His father was a publican in Sunderland, and in a very big pub, made a lot of money. Run off with the barmaid, or ditched his wife and lived with the barmaid. Wife moved to Gisborough with 5 kids, most of them girls, 2 boys, 1 girl. One of the sons was the village policeman in the village on Heartbeat. And the village shop in Heartbeat went from him to his son, my cousin, who died about 5 years ago. So it wouldn't, surely he doesn't want to watch something else, but I always watch Heartbeat. It's one of my. However, the that was Will Lightwing. The Dinah Brown. I got a chap from up there, a plumber, to put my central heating in, and he did it at a price far less than London plumbers would. He's prepared to go anywhere in the country. Then he developed chest trouble, and he's now a plumbing teacher at a technical college in Sunderland. And I got another chap named Steve Brown, and he came down to finish my work off at Corby. And we were sitting chatting, we were talking about. I have 3 houses on the seafront at a village called Skinning Grove between Saltburn and Staithes. And he said, and he'd done some work down there. And I said, the mining museum at Skinning Grove was set up by a chap named Tommy Leonard, who was a Yorkshire Post reporter and who visited us and talked with me in Korea. I said, I sat with his sister Marjorie in the village school. Yes, they always made boys sit with girls to keep quiet or something. And I said, and later on, I said, I sat with your namesake, Dinah Brown. He said, that was my mother. This was last year, imagine. I mean, all these interconnected things. It's a, and anyway, I wanted to ask him really how he came to be brown when his mother was married to this chap, Watson, but I daren't. However, there we are. Another career story from my youngest, my brothers followed me into the Territorial Army, and they went into the Green Howards, a local regiment, 4th Battalion, which I was posted to when I came back from Korea, because it was my local regiment. And then I transferred to the Hallamshires in Sheffield when I was posted by the Ministry of Supply to an ordnance factory near Rotherham. And anyway, about 5 years ago, my youngest brother, Stuart, who'd been a sergeant in the Green Howards, a very active territorial NCO, he ran the drill hall at Scarborough for many years, and my next brother, Philip, had also been involved at Scarborough, and he only joined to be a cook because he trained as a Peggy boy in the Merchant Navy when he virtually ran away from home because he didn't want to work with my father, who was a builder, and became a galley slave in an oil tanker and learnt his cooking. And then he found, in the days when the Territorial Army went down to nothing and Lord Gisborough was the commanding officer on a voluntary basis almost, he became voluntarily a combat cook and became B2 qualified and so on. And then when his building bad, business was bad in the winter, he'd go and work as an assistant chef in the Grand Hotel and the other smart hotels in Scarborough and help with the drill hall. However, keen soldier that he was, Brother Stuart says to me with a big smile, he said, had a drink in a pub in Redcar a couple of weeks ago, and a chap came up to me and he said, you're a windspear, aren't you? And I said, I was. He said, well, he said, I want to shake your hand, he said, because your brother Leslie saved my uncle's life in Korea. And with a big smile, he said, what do you do? And I said, Stuart, I can't remember. I don't recall saving anybody's life. He said, well, he wouldn't say something like that. It's not the sort of thing people make up. I said, I know. I said, but I can't think of any occasion that I did anything out of the ordinary. Like saving somebody's life. Imagine, beaming smile and proud of this. And here's me undermining him, you know, and his face dropped. And I said, I'm sorry, but, you know, I said, I don't know anything about it. I said, what was his name? He said, oh, I didn't ask him. It was just, he came and he said his piece and went. I said, I only knew, I think of one chap in lived in Redcar. He was in the Green Howards with me, and I saw him years later when he said to me that he'd been married, divorced, and he got a kid nearly as big as you. That's me. It couldn't have been him. So I said, there we are. Anyway, it was only about two years ago. Let's say that happened 3-4 years ago. I went to Bulgaria. I bought some property there. I own 12 houses. I've got an email here. Went off yesterday to about some building work to get the first house so that I can live in it. And I'm dealing with an estate agent who bought most of my houses, which I didn't pay a lot of money for. And she was telling me about the days after communism. This was the woman running the office manager of the estate agents in a place called Rusa, which has the only bridge over the Danube into Romania, which the Russians built in about 1952. And I am sitting overlooking Freedom Square, which is a big open area with trees and so on, not like Tiananmen Square, but a nice parkland and full of cafes and picturesque umbrellas and so on. She was telling me about that her father had lost his job, that the steelworks had closed, mother had got a job in the next town, and she managed to find a part-time job in there. And I sort of, more to counter her story, I said, yes, well, I said, people don't realise that in Britain we had rationing up to the 1955, and that, life wasn't all that easy. And I said, I have a few memories from those days. I said, my father was a jobbing builder, and I said, about that time, I might have been at grammar school where I got a scholarship at 13, having failed the 11 plus, but I might have been a bit younger, perhaps 12, perhaps even 11, but he was doing a lot of concreting, and I used to have to mix the concrete. He'd mix the first lot, and I had to carry it in zinc buckets, and I developed a coolie trot, carry two buckets of cement, and carry them into him, and he'd lay them, and so on. And I got home one night, and my mother said, what's that red mark under your mouth? And it was a mark of my teeth. I'd been biting my lip, concentrating. I'd bitten through the skin. She said, well, get some Vaseline on it and make sure you don't do it tomorrow. And I said, we all had to work when we were young, didn't we, to keep the show on the road. So I was the eldest of six. And about coming back on the plane from Bulgaria, I remembered the only incident it could have been when I saved somebody's life. And I hadn't even thought about it. Seymour and I was on our second position after Yongdong, where I first started mapping the minefields. There was a left forward company position and a right forward company position, a reserve company behind making a triangle, and the mortar platoon behind that. I remember that part well, because when the Hallamshires found I'd been recommended for a commission in Korea, they asked me if I would take that commission with the territorial unit in Sheffield, and I agreed. And I went off to Mons Officer Cadet School eventually, having passed the commissioning board. I was there for, I think, 3 weeks as a territorial. They couldn't insist you did more than 2 weeks, but you could do three. And I had 6 weeks leave as an executive officer in the civil service, and so I got paid twice, which suited me nicely. And on the first day, our squad of about 20, we're marching in three ranks, and we give our eyes right to salute an officer. And I looked at the officer, and he looked at me, and we recognized each other. It was my company commander from Charlie Company in Germany, Charlie Company in Korea. He'd been promoted to Lieutenant Colonel, and he was IC basic training at Mons Officer Cadet School. And anyway, we got into our squad hut, and some things I remember, our squad instructor was Captain Lockheed of the Royal Artillery. We just got sat down in this room, about four times as big as this room. When there was a knock at the door, and the door opened, and comes the Lieutenant Colonel with his hat in his hand, and he put his hand up. He said, carry on, Captain Lockheed. I've just come for a word with Winspear over there. And he came up and sat down beside my little desk at the and he said, well, what have you been doing since last time I saw you? Now, he was officer commanding this left forward company. And just forward of that was a feature called Pimple, overlooking the another tributary of the Sabichon, which had forked lower down. About 5 kilometres up from where I picked up the agents, it went right up the front and marked, in fact, the boundary between the enemy and own lines, and went left, there were two tributaries, one in front of the hook, and then but the big one went right back of this unmanned feature that I've been describing. And then that's the one they used to follow and get inside the lines. But the Pimple was isolated, and that's where Speakman of the Royal of the Scottish Borderers got his Victoria Cross. It wasn't manned in our day because it had been a platoon position, but it was almost like Warsaw had been manned in the U.S. Marines' day, but because they were isolated on a spur and so on, they invited attack by the Chinese, and you know, and just to train a new battalion sort of thing, and people got killed unnecessarily, so they were emptied. Anyway, the only way to get it was across open ground, and you had to walk down the road, and the jeep head at the behind it had two revetments cut into the hillside with overhead cover, and yes, two. You went down the spur, but then you had about thick end of a kilometre to walk across this open road. Sometimes you got fired at, and we used to walk, Seymour and I, 5 yards apart. We still talk to each other, but you get there's a bullet went past something, but it was fired from about 1,500 yards away, so it wasn't going to. They'd be damned lucky to hit you. I was asked on one occasion to show a new mortar officer the forward positions, who'd just come in as reinforcement, and I took him along there. And every time a bullet came zipping past, he dived into the monsoon ditch on the side of the road, and I just carried on walking. We didn't say anything. But he'd been my platoon commander in the officer cadet training unit at Imphal Barracks, York, that I was put in when I first joined. And I'd been back squadded twice for not showing soldier-like qualities for some reason or other. Practical jokes mostly, but one of them was because I still wore my pyjama trousers under my greatcoat and boots and gaiters when we were hauled out in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning to go up onto Strensland Barracks when day broke. They'd called us out and put us on the truck, but they'd never taken us out of barracks before, so I thought it was going to be the same thing. So I was still wearing my grey flannel pyjamas there. Of course, in daylight, this was spotted, and I was back squadding. However, this was Captain Hardy, who, with Shuttleworth, had been played rugby for England. And Captain Hardy had a sort of method of training, which was, go, 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 go! You're going over the assault course or something. And there was Go, Go Hardy, diving in the monsoon ditch at my feet, which delighted me no end. He took over the mortar platoon and did his job very well afterwards. Seymour and I are crossing this open ground, and there's a jeep behind the hill being unloaded of defence stores, barbed wire and pickets and so on, when a mortar barrage started. They must have seen the jeep going over. It had taken them minutes, maybe half hour, to get things organised, but then. Now, we're getting closer. Now, I was going up to the gunner observation post on the top for some reason. I'd been asked to look in there, our only means of liaison with these other arms was direct, because their wireless nets were so complicated, you couldn't get on them. The Centurion tanks weren't too bad, because they had a telephone at the back of the tank. You could run after a tank, open the box, take the telephone out, you talk to the driver, which was a help, but that was all. Anyway, Seymour and I are getting, and we're both walking along the bottom of the monsoon ditches on either side of the road, and we're getting nearer and nearer. In the first salvo, two chaps had gone down and stayed down, and the others ran into the revetment. Then after a while, two or three stonks, 20 rounds. And they went back, and they'd come out and they tried to carry on with the job, because the driver would want to get his truck and jeep emptied and away again, for obvious reasons. One of these chaps was moving, and one wasn't. So we're getting closer and closer. I shouted across, "We're going to have to synchronise this with." I said, "We'll trot 50 yards, and as soon as the last one will start, as soon as the last one stops. And then when it starts again, we'll drop down again." And he didn't reply, no need to reply. We got closer, and we could. I said, "When we get to the lads, I'm going to drop my rifle. You'll have to get mine and theirs. and I'm going to grab them and drag them into the revetment. And they were only wearing musketry order, but it was 44 pattern, which had this harness on the back. And so we got there, dropped my rifle, turned one over, and picked him up by the, and ran in with my coolie trot into the jeep revetment. Dropped them down, still on their faces, shattered, slumped down in the corner, and then another stonk started, and shrapnel was coming off the ground outside and up into the beams above. And one chap, I remember saying, I don't know what to do with my tin hat, whether I keep it on my head or I put it over my balls. So to talk, to lighten the atmosphere. Anyway, I get my breath back, and Seymour sitting across the other side, and I signal to him something like, next up, you see. And so as soon as the last bomb drops, 2-3 seconds, I get up, he gets up, and away up the hill. Somebody was already putting a shell dressing on one of these chaps' injuries and so on. Now that's the only thing it could have been, and it was the buckets of concrete on the Danube in Rusa that was the key to remembering it. What a... And I haven't told my youngest brother yet, because I haven't seen him. You know, it might cheer him up a bit. But there we are. That's the only thing it could have been. Now, I mean, well, I didn't regard it as anything special. I was going that way anyway.